Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, welcome everyone. Pleasure to see you all here at the LSE. This is a hybrid event, and it's being hosted both by the Center for Macroeconomics, of which my name is Ricardo Reyes and I'm the director of it, as well as by the School of Public Policy, directed by Andres Velasco, sitting there. We're very pleased tonight to be joined by Pablo Hernandez de Cos, who will be joining us, and to share some of these lessons from almost 6 years of heading the Banco de España. In this event, Pablo is the governor of the Banco de España, and as part of that, he's also a member of the governing and the general council of the ECB. He's also the chair of the BCBS, of the board of governors of the SEMLA Institute in Latin America, and also of the advisory technical committee of the ESRB. He has been a student, a teacher, and a practitioner of monetary policy for now maybe 2 decades, I would say, maybe even more, which he did following his PhD at the Complutense University, as well as his first degree at CUNEF, one of the great institutions in Spain. Pablo is going to be joining us here today to talk about his lessons from 6 years as a governor of the Banco de España, his lessons for monetary policy over the last few years, over being there, if you want, in the room, making sense of why inflation was going up, how to bring it down, and so on. I really want to pass to him, but there's some things that I'm supposed to say in which I have not said any of them yet, but here they are. Please put your phones on silent so as to not disrupt the event. This event is being recorded and will be put in the LSE YouTube channel very soon. Pablo will be speaking for 40-ish minutes, and then we'll open the floor for questions for another 15 or 20 minutes. You'll have a chance to ask your questions. For those of you in the online audience, there's a feature for you to ask questions online, and I'll read some of those from the tablet. When you do ask a question, and I will remind you again, it is really very helpful for those of us on the stage if you just say your name and your affiliation, even if you want to remember who asked what and then be able to answer them. So please do remember to do that. For the X users, the day's hashtag is hashtag LSE Spain. With that in mind, Pablo, thank you so much for coming to the LSE. It's really a pleasure to have you, and we want to learn about monetary policy from you right now.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. It's a real pleasure to be here. And yes, it's right. It holds a special significance to me to be here today. This event is occurring just a month before I end my term as governor of Banco de España. And I've just done a small change to the title of this conference. You see here that my initial intention, also because Ricardo asked me about it, is just, why don't you provide us with some lessons? And I've moved to reflections. I mean, lessons was a bit too... and my intention, yes, is okay, with my policy maker perspective, to give you some insights, okay, of what I've learned in this very high inflationary episode now, deflationary episode, perhaps with the main intention of to provide you with some topics on which you might in the future do some research, because of course I don't have any definitive answer at this stage. And I will be summarizing it in 10 points. Okay, I don't know whether I will be able to finish the 10 points. Ricardo will tell me, depending on how quick I'm in trying to explain all of them. So I should, of course, start by trying to describe in a very quick manner what has happened, okay? And I will be focusing on euro area inflation in the euro area, okay? Well, you have there the chart on the left. Annual rate of inflation in the euro area rose from very low levels late 2020 to 10.6% in October 2022, which is, by all means, an unprecedented figure in the history of the monetary union. This surge in inflation was caused by a series of exceptional shocks that impacted various components of inflation. In early 2021, as economies were reopening from the pandemic, inflationary pressures emerged when the release of pent-up demand and all the accumulated savings that households had have done, underpinned also by the synchronized, very expansionary monetary and fiscal policies around the globe, they confronted this increasing demand with a supply system severely affected by restrictions. You know, they were the still restrictions on the supply side of the economy. And it is precisely this demand-supply mismatch which rapidly impacted commodity prices first, especially energy ones, which emerged as the main factor behind the inflation surge. And this is what you see in the green bar in the chart. Then inflationary pressures gathered pace in 2022, and this was exacerbated by the impact on energy and other commodity prices by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. As a net energy importer, the euro area was particularly exposed to this shock. And it's interesting to see that other commodities, and including now food, which is the yellow bar in the chart, for which we know energy and energy-intensive products such as fertilizers are important production inputs, were also affected, spreading the inflationary pressure across the consumption basket. For much of 2021 and 2022, these factors were further compounded by a depreciation of the euro. Okay, in our case, there was a significant depreciation of the euro, making imported goods and services more expensive, and this is something that we have also to take into account. In addition, the gradual materialization of indirect effects of energy cost increases and supply chain bottlenecks led to a steady increase in non-energy industrial goods and services inflation. And this is basically red and blue bars, respectively, in the same chart. Then in late 2022, inflation embarked upon a downward path, supported initially by a sharp correction of energy inflation, and over time by the effect of monetary policy tightening and the gradual unwinding of adverse supply shocks. In the euro area, this disinflationary process is fairly advanced, but has yet to be completed. Inflation stood at 2.4%, according to the numbers that were published yesterday by Eurostat in April 2024. And based on ECB staff projections, the inflation rate will continue to ease, although with a somewhat bumpy profile in the short term. Indeed, there are at least three factors why we might be observing this bumpy profile during basically the whole 2024 year. First is energy-based effect. Second is the unwinding of crisis-related fiscal measures. And then third, the relatively slow moderation of services inflation, which is something that we have also seen in the past, no? This more stickiness of services inflation, which in the end will make the inflation rate to fluctuate around the current numbers before reaching our 2% target in mid-2025. So let's now focus on the chart on the right, which is basically the forecasting errors that we made during this period and the decomposition of these forecasting errors. What it is very clear from the chart, these are quarter on quarter errors. Okay, so we are not focusing on long-term or medium-term errors, but simply one quarter projecting the next quarter and whether we made it right or not. What you can see is that large and rising positive forecast errors were observed until the second quarter of 2022, shortly after the start of the Ukrainian war. Forecast errors then began to decline after the third quarter of 2022, and especially during 2023, coinciding with the disinflationary process when errors became small or even negative at some point. Initially, looking now at the composition of these errors, initially the underprediction of inflation mainly reflected upward surprises related to the dramatic increase in energy commodity prices and their impact on consumer prices. This is basically the orange bars there. Perhaps here I should emphasize that the projections that are made by the staff They don't incorporate a forecast in itself on energy prices. They are just taking the energy prices that are assumed by markets at each point in time. Okay, this is important. In early 2022, food prices started also to play a significant role, while the speed and intensity with which energy and food inflation passed through to core inflation was higher than initially expected as well. And in 2023, the contribution to total projection errors coming from energy commodity prices was also significant, but in the opposite direction, contributing to an overprediction of inflation at some point in time. So maybe the most interesting element that I wanted to emphasize here is that an important element coming from this exercise is that even after controlling for the successive outward surprises in energy commodity prices and other technical assumptions, fiscal and monetary policies as well, inflation forecast errors have remained positive and account for around 30% of total forecast errors. So the residuals that you can we cannot explain, but all these initial assumptions is still 30%. And this finding would suggest that our main forecasting models had a hard time capturing how the large shocks I have described are transmitted to inflation over time. And by the way, this is a finding that is not unique to the ECB Eurosystem projections, as it has also been observed in other jurisdictions, for sure in the UK, but also at the Fed. Perhaps it's even more interesting that our own research, the one that has been produced by the ECB Bank of Spain, suggests possible reasons why model-based forecasts did not accurately capture the transmission of those large shocks to inflation. And in particular, econometric evidence and simulation exercises show that standard linear forecast models do not properly capture the transmission of large commodity price shocks to energy inflation. And one possible explanation for these non-linearities is that when facing large shocks to their input costs, firms tend to update their prices more frequently and hence pass on the cost increases to selling prices also more quickly. And this makes inflation increase more intensively than in normal times of low and stable inflation, thus further hindering the accuracy of linear model-based predictions as the ones that we usually use, you know, and the staff uses in order to produce the forecast every quarter. So first lesson I would draw for this is that, central banks should endeavor to make our forecast machinery better equipped to handle large shocks and project their impact on inflation over the medium run. And in fact, we are already taking steps in that direction. And I think additionally, we have also to emphasize that we have learned that complementing the baseline projections that are produced by the staff with alternative scenarios characterized, for example, by paths for key external assumptions that differ from those in the baseline are extremely helpful in a context of high uncertainty like the one that we experience and that we are still experiencing. My second point concerns the nature of the shocks that dominated the inflation surge. And here, what it is shown also in this slide is the research that shows that the main drivers of inflation in the euro area have been supply-side shocks, with a more limited role for demand shocks. And this is, of course, in contrast, you have both the euro area and the US and the decomposition of the shocks for inflation in different periods. As you can see in the US, inflation was dominated by demand side factors. And of course, we also know that the nature of the shocks driving inflation is not an academic curiosity, and in fact determines how central banks respond optimally to those shocks in practice. And let me perhaps mention something that was stated in the ECB monetary policy strategy that we published back in 2021. There is a paragraph that says, as different types of shock may move inflation and real economy activity in the same direction, as in the case of demand shocks, or create a temporary trade-off, as in the case of supply shocks, the medium-term orientation provides of the ECB, of inflation, the inflation target, provides the policy flexibility to assess the origin of shocks and look through temporary shocks that may dissipate of their own accord, thus avoiding unnecessary volatility in activity and employment. And I think this paragraph encapsulates two key considerations when confronting adverse supply shocks. First one is that, of course, in the face of a negative supply shock, inflation increases while output typically falls below potential, and that introduces a meaningful trade-off for monetary policy. An aggressive reaction to quench inflationary pressures may produce an excessive contraction in economic activity, and that should justify to be more patient. Of course, patient does not mean inaction, and this brings me to the second consideration that I draw from this paragraph. Whether a central bank should look through temporary supply shocks hinges critically on whether such shocks are expected to have a transitory effect on inflation or instead are expected to affect inflation over the medium term, which is the relevant horizon again for monetary policy. As I mentioned before, the adverse supply shocks that hit the euro area back in 21 and 22 had rather persistent effects on inflation, affecting the medium-term inflation outlook and therefore justifying a forceful monetary policy response by the ECB once it started. This analysis also shows how important it is for central banks to have an accurate assessment of how ongoing supply shocks are likely to affect inflation over the policy relevant horizon. And in this regard, the lessons that I also draw is very closely related to the previous one. We have to analyze very well the data and also to improve our forecasting tools, our knowledge of how different tools and shocks are passed through to inflation over the forecasting horizon. And this should allow us to better decide how patient or impatient to be in the face of different types of shocks, whether supply ones or elsewhere. And I think this is important also because I think we have also this perception that there are good reasons to believe that the supply side shocks may become more frequent in the future. It's important that this lesson and that all these tools that we should develop are done quickly. Third point that I wanted to focus on is related to this question of how should monetary policy respond in a context of very high uncertainty. The truth is that central banks, we do not know how persistent a given supply shock will be, nor do we know whether a supply shock will be followed by another one. And the interesting thing is that when one looks at theory is far from providing a clear answer as to how monetary policy should react in a highly uncertain environment. And there are even two very opposing views here. First one, we have the classic Brainard attenuation principle that states that monetary policy should be conservative in the face of uncertainty about the impact of underlying shocks on inflation or on the impact of any policy miscalibration on inflation. And indeed, the greater the uncertainty following this principle, the higher the probability that a more aggressive monetary policy response to shocks may move inflation and output away from target. Okay? But then there is also an alternative strand of the literature, which is usually referred to as robust control, that provides guidance pointing exactly in the opposite direction. If shocks are persistent and second-round effects materialize, it pays off to be more aggressive and keep longer-term expectations well anchored. And indeed, the experience of the 70s show that shocks can be concatenated, especially when they originate on the supply side of the economy, with a strong additive effects on economic variables. And in this case, theory suggests that monetary policy should be more reactive in order to prevent backward-looking behavior from becoming embedded in economic expectations. So here, my own takeaways from the extensive literature on monetary policy and the relationship with uncertainty and my own experience of the last years are threefold. So first, monetary policy should not be paralyzed in the face of uncertainty. Central banks need to remain preemptive and forward-looking. Second, there is no general rule for monetary policy to be either attenuated or more activist in an uncertain environment. And finally, a risk management approach is probably crucial. And the later point requires pragmatism, requires also judgment, which must be based on a critical examination of the evidence and the realization that patterns observed in the past can change rapidly And in this respect, as I mentioned earlier, when making decisions in the present, it's crucial to be well equipped not only with a baseline projection scenario, but also with alternative scenarios and simulation exercises easing the different assumptions underlying the baseline. And to a certain extent, the ECB's reaction to the current inflationary and disinflationary episode has been based to a great extent, again, on these principles. The concepts of optionality, gradualism, and flexibility have guided our policy and are a good example of this approach. Indeed, we have responded to this new context by increasing optionality and emphasizing that we will act in a data-dependent manner in order to deliver our mandate on price stability. So let me now move to my fourth point, which is, well, try to answer the question of why the sacrifice ratio has been apparently been so low, and how does it relate to anchor inflation expectations? And what you have in this slide is precisely long-term inflation expectations for the euro area based on markets on the right and on analysts and market surveys on the left. So, of course, the starting point here is that, to me, is a striking feature of this episode is that the disinflation process has taken place without a major loss of economic activity. It is true that the euro area GDP decelerated notably in 2023, growing by an anemic 0.4%. But given the scale of monetary policy tightening, it can be argued that the sacrifice ratio of bringing inflation down has been relatively low so far. Let me highlight two possible reasons why the sacrifice ratio appears to have been so low so far. First, the severity of the output inflation trade-off crucially depends on inflation expectations. In the new Keynesian Phillips curve, a rise in inflation expectations shifts the relationship between the short-term output gap and inflation upwards. This implies that stabilizing output at potential does not suffice to bring inflation back to target. Instead, the central bank must depress output below potential in order to achieve the inflation target. In the case of the latest inflationary episode, there was a very clear risk and real risk that the sharp and persistent rise in inflation would eventually lead to a de-anchoring of medium and long-term inflation expectations above target. However, at least as it is seen in this slide, in the euro area, inflation expectations over medium and long-term horizons have remained broadly anchored to our 2% target. This fact is, to me, one of the main reasons why the sacrifice ratio has been relatively small compared to previous inflationary episodes where supply shocks predominated, such as the oil price shocks of the 70s and the subsequent costly disinflation. But there is also a second argument. The output inflation trade-off depends as well on the slope of this relationship. How much output has to fall to bring inflation down for given inflation expectations? In the basic new Keynesian model, this slope is higher the higher the frequency with which firms adjust their prices to changes in their cost and demand conditions. So earlier, I argued that one consequence of the recent episode of high inflation was that firms changed their prices more frequently, accelerating the transmission of shocks to inflation. But by the same token, faster repricing by firms implies that inflation is more sensitive to changes in aggregate demand. So, in other words, the Phillips curve becomes steeper, allowing the central bank to achieve the same reduction in inflation with smaller output losses, hence reducing the sacrifice ratio. And indeed, the optimal monetary policy prescriptions in this situation has been analyzed by the Bank of Spain, ECB, and Banco de Chile in a recent paper, and the main conclusion is that the central bank should strike while the iron is hot. In other words, fight inflation by countering firms' inflationary aspirations, thereby achieving a lower sacrifice ratio. And again, in my view, this illustrates the crucial importance for central banks of acting and communicating in a way that keeps inflation expectations well anchored. So let me now move to the fifth point I wanted to make, which is something on which we've been discussing for long in the last 3 years is how has monetary policy transmission work? So we know that the last monetary policy tightening has been exceptional, and this has been exceptional in terms of size and speed, and it has been also following a long period of unconventional expansionary monetary policy and negative interest rates. The previous hiking cycle was in 2005, and since then there have been structural changes in the economy, but also in the banking system. For example, banks are now better capitalized and have higher liquidity ratios than in the past. And moreover, the last monetary policy tightening took place in a context of adverse supply shocks, weak growth, and high uncertainty, in contrast to the positive demand shocks that predominated during the 2005 monetary policy tightening. So I guess all these features may potentially have altered the strength and the speed of the monetary policy transmission in the euro area. And indeed, the evidence that we have, accumulated during the last 3 years, is that so far, the unprecedented scale and speed of the last rate hiking cycle in a context of adverse supply shocks, weak growth, and high uncertainty appears to have contributed to amplifying the tightening of financing conditions through two main channels. One is higher risk premia, and then also tighter credit standards. And as a consequence, and this is something that you can see very well on the chart on the right, non-linearities have emerged, credit flows in particular have been more intense. The slowdown in credit flows have been more intense than predicted by linear models based on historical patterns, as what you see is precisely the errors that have been committed, you know, by the staff in trying to predict loans flows in the last 3 years. However, it's also important to emphasize that the strong growth in nominal income during this period, in a context of robust employment and also robust profit growth, has slowed the increase in the percentage of vulnerable indebted households and firms. And this probably is also behind the fact that we haven't observed amplification mechanisms across the banking system. Okay, and this is also important. So these non-linearities were concentrated in the evolution of credit flows, but at least we didn't observe an amplification mechanism on default rates or credit risk deterioration of households and firms. And this is because, in particular, employment growth was very positive. Income growth also, not only for households, but also for firms, was significantly high. I'm talking first on the first channel of monetary policy transmission, which is from our actions to financing conditions. But of course, then there is a second leg, which is from financing conditions to growth and inflation. And here, the evidence that we have is that since the start of the recent monetary policy tightening cycle, the projections have been systematically overestimating GDP growth. Okay? And these downward surprises do not seem to be fully explained by errors in the technical assumptions, as this was the case also with inflation, including the changes in the fiscal and monetary policy stance. And again, this evidence, these errors, might be signaling a stronger transmission of monetary policy to macro variables than in the past, although here we have an important caveat, which is that the labor market has demonstrated remarkable resilience over the past 2 years, as illustrated also by the lower than expected unemployment rates compared with the staff projections. So there, the errors were on the opposite side. And here, what you have in this slide is complementary econometric evidence that basically shows that in the recent tightening cycle, the transmission of monetary policy to GDP growth and inflation may have been somewhat more intense than observed on average before this unprecedented tightening cycle, but this is especially the case for growth, which is the chart on the left, while the evidence on inflation is less clear, less conclusive. This analysis at least partly why we are still making the point that monetary policy transmission is forceful, and it remains a downward risk to the euro area growth outlook, which in turn is also an important factor behind our assessment that the risk to the inflation outlook are now balanced, so that this is balanced or the risks that go in the opposite direction. So let me move to my sixth point, which is related to QT, to quantitative tightening. Now, this was one of the novelties also of this episode. It's obvious that the macro financial effects of quantitative easing have been extensively analyzed. The theory shows that QE mainly impacts yields through anticipation effects. Investors react to their expectations about how much debt the central bank will extract over time from the market, so that risk-averse market participants will not have to hold it. And in part, this involves the concept of extraction risk. And in particular, in the euro area, duration risk extraction is reinforced by the extraction of sovereign credit risk, which we know that is also an important channel. But now, of course, central banks are embarked in QT, in quantitative tightening, and we still need to understand the impact of central banks reducing their asset portfolios. And in this regard, there are several reasons to expect that the observed effects of QT will not just be the mirror image of QE, even if central bank purchases and sales of assets have a fundamentally symmetric impact on market conditions. Nonetheless, the manner, but also the circumstances of QE expansions and QT contractions may cause their observed effects to differ. And let me mention a few of those elements. First, QE policies were often implemented at moments of high market stress, when their effects are larger, whereas central banks have waited for times of market tranquility before embarking on QT. That's an important difference. Second, QT took the form of outright purchases, but QT is now taking the form of a passive runoff of bond portfolios. And then finally, the announcement of large-scale QE programs, such as the PPP program, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program of the ECB, often came as a surprise to the market, while the current QT path has been carefully announced ahead of time to avoid any surprise tightening. In view of the different contexts in which QE and QT have taken place, it's unsurprising, I would say, that empirical studies of QT find much smaller effects than those attributed to QE. And I would also add that the recent experience seems to validate the gradual and predictable approach to QT adopted by central banks. Had QT not been carefully signaled beforehand, its effects would likely have been much larger. At the same time, the experience of central banks that faced some bumps on the road to balance sheet normalization shows that temporary flexibility in its implementation can be useful. And moreover, as I think it's also important to stress, that as excess liquidity in the system decreases alongside the central bank's balance sheet runoff, it will also be important to monitor market developments and analyze which investor types are absorbing the increased supply of bonds. Likewise, it will be essential to ensure that reserves remain ample at the end point of the QT process, as otherwise the impact of QT may be larger and the risk of liquidity events may increase. So let me now move to my seventh point, monetary policy and financial stability. The link, we have also had several episodes on, there was a certain trade-off at some point, no, between monetary policy and financial stability. So again, let me recall here the monetary policy strategy review of the ECB back in 2021, which basically underscored that financial stability is a precondition for price stability and vice versa. And in practice, on many occasions, the pursuit of price stability through monetary policy is complementary to that of financial stability. But, of course, we also know that there are cases in which a trade-off between the two objectives arises, as in cases in which bank solvency issues emerge in a high inflation environment. These solvency issues should be mitigated by a proper supervision and resolution framework and by the action of fiscal authorities. However, monetary policy may have to react, taking into account that the financial crisis is likely to lead to the emergence of prolonged disinflationary forces that should ease this trade-off between monetary and financial stability over time, albeit at a potentially high cost in terms of output losses. So in my view, recent events, including both the pandemic crisis and the current inflationary episode, have witnessed monetary policy responses that have successfully been able to pursue the price stability mandate without undermining price stability. And the two best examples, I will not enter into the details, are for sure the pandemic program in 2020, but then, of course, second, in 2021, the announcement of the Transmission Protection Mechanism, the TPI, the famous TPI, that occurred in an environment of mounting inflationary pressures and of a monetary policy tightening stance, and the TPI allowed to stabilize markets and to support the smooth functioning of financial markets. In my view, the TPI has been absolutely crucial to allow for a forceful monetary policy reaction to tackle the inflation problem. So in this regard, the conclusions reached in our monetary policy strategy back in 2021 to explicitly take financial stability considerations into account in monetary policy deliberations seems valid. It is under this framework that any monetary policy response to financial stability concerns will depend on prevailing circumstances and will be guided by the implications for price stability. And in practical terms, this means is basically that we have an integrated framework of economic analysis, of monetary and financial analysis, that it is used to measure developments in financial vulnerabilities and macroprudential measures as well, and their impact in the end on output and inflation, including in the medium and long run. Okay, let me now move to my eighth point, which is also something that on which we've learned a lot during these 3 years, which is not the connection between monetary and financial stability, but between monetary and fiscal policy. So the COVID-19 pandemic clearly demonstrated that fiscal and monetary policy can be complementary. However, as we emerged from the pandemic and the inflationary shocks took hold, monetary and fiscal policies increasingly risk pulling in opposite direction, losing effectiveness in the process. Fiscal policy responded to the start of the war in Ukraine with measures to mitigate the impact of the energy and food prices shock on households and also on firms. However, many of these measures were not sufficiently selective or targeted at most vulnerable groups, resulting in an expansionary impulse that was broader than necessary, thus adding to inflationary pressures. Here, probably the main conclusion that we should draw is that monetary and fiscal policies are more effective when their stances are mutually supportive. And if we want to apply this conclusion to the current context, this should mean that fiscal policy should help avoid additional inflationary pressures and associated monetary policy response. And even with a more medium-term perspective, I think it's important that fiscal policies adopt a horizon on which commitment to public debt sustainability is key, and also in order to increase the fiscal space, which is now very low or even non-existent in many European countries. And here, of course, we have one instrument, which is the Stability and Growth Pact, which has been just reformed. So an effective and transparent implementation of this new Stability and Growth Pact is of the essence. Of course, if we want to talk of monetary policy and fiscal policy, it's also very important to mention that there are still some elements missing in order in the European European Monetary Union governance in order to ensure the proper functioning of the policy mix in the euro area. And this is basically that to achieve this objective, a central fiscal capacity is required, one of adequate size and with sufficient and reliable funding to allow for effective macroeconomic stabilization at the monetary union level, something that, of course, any other country has, and that, of course, the monetary union doesn't. Let me now move to my nine points, point, which is related to R-star, the natural rate of interest, and to what extent this is a useful concept for monetary policy in action. What it is clear is that a significant takeaway from the monetary policy tightening cycle pertains to this issue, and whether this is useful or not. Throughout the tightening cycle, policy institutions, but also researchers, have worked to identify movements in the natural rate of interest, seeking to determine how contractionary monetary policy was each step of the way. This approach will perhaps even become more important as we reach the final stages of the disinflation process, where in principle real policy rates should be converging to the natural real rate, whether they that may lie. In my view, one of the most important lessons to be learned from this analysis often comes in the preface, which consistently highlight the high level of uncertainty associated with estimating the natural rate. So here you have a chart on the different estimates with different models that we have. This was published in an ECB monthly bulletin paper just very recently. The range of estimates for the real natural rate in the euro area implies nominal natural rates ranging from 1.5 to 3%. And furthermore, each of these point estimates across different methodologies comes with a significant margin of error. So how do we conduct monetary policy when estimates of the natural rate of interest are subject to such high uncertainty? Well, the interesting thing is that there is research on this, by the way, by some of the people who had some of the seminal papers on the estimation empirically of our star. And the conclusion, which I think is still valid, is that in the face of such uncertainty, the policy rate should be inertial, in the sense that the previous rate should serve as the primary reference point, largely replacing the natural rate, with adjustments made based on inflation and estimated output gaps. This approach not only mitigates the impact of estimation errors, but also advocates for gradual adjustments in the policy rate, driven solely by estimated gaps, thereby promoting a data-dependent approach, which, by the way, is the one that we are following also at the ECB. In addition to this, I would like to emphasize another dimension of information available to central banks, one that is also often overlooked in studies focusing on Taylor rule for interest rates. When central banks announce their decisions, they gain valuable insight into whether they have surprised financial markets, and if so, the extent to which these surprises impact expectations of inflation and economic activity. In a context of very high uncertainty, a careful interpretation of these signals often proves to be the most effective tool for assessing the stance of monetary policy. Okay, so this is a second conclusion that I would draw from this. And then I will just enter into my final point, and maybe with 2 minutes it would be more than enough, which is now the connection between monetary policy and supply-side policies. And I think the concept of R star is useful precisely to illustrate some of the interactions between this monetary policy and structural reforms or supply-side policies, as whatever you want to call them. What we have, what it is observed in this chart, even if there has been an increase in R star in the last 2 or 3 years, the level is still very low, okay? And well, empirical studies attribute this very low and the secular drop in R star mainly to the decline in trend productivity growth, demographic developments, but also they find a role for other factors which affect the balance between supply of savings and the demand for investment, such as fiscal policy or capital flows. We know also that going forward, new factors such as the green transition, the slowdown in the globalization process, are likely to also play a role, since they have the potential to reduce the long-run level of output and income, and hence the supply of savings, but also to mobilize a large amount of investment, so it's difficult to say in which direction this change will be. But what I think is important to emphasize is that in this context, structural reform policies or supply-side policies that can raise potential output growth and the equilibrium real interest rates may play a crucial role in providing monetary policy with more room for maneuver, meaning that monetary policy is less likely to be constrained, if this is the case, if these reforms are applied, by the effective lower bound for interest rates, and by extension, less likely to resort to unconventional policies. In addition, we also know that the structural reforms that foster potential output would also entail the output gap closing at a higher level of output, at which point monetary policy would have to return to a neutral stance, and this would make debt levels, both public and private, more sustainable at any given level of interest rates, ensuring that governments, households, and firms have less need to make adjustments. And there is even an additional important point here is that more generally, structural reforms have the capacity to make the economy more resilient to shocks, which would be particularly key for the smooth functioning of monetary policy. A flexible and more resilient economy is more likely to adjust to shocks through prices, which are also expected to fade quickly, the impact on prices, keeping inflation expectations anchored, and thus facilitating the work of monetary policy. We also know that in a context of flexible markets and a high degree of competition, monetary policy actions will also be more effective, feeding through the economy more quickly. And these benefits are particularly relevant in a monetary union and in the European Monetary Union, for sure, since structural reforms can reduce cross-country economic divergence, making a single monetary policy more appropriate for all countries. And by making national economies more flexible, structural reforms can also reduce the likelihood of macroeconomic imbalances, such as financial or current account imbalances that played a very significant role in the global financial crisis and later on in the sovereign debt crisis. And of course, this reduction on macro imbalances is also key for the correct functioning, of the euro area. So all in all, to me, these factors justify the need to place more emphasis on structural policies in the coming years to increase the resilience and the growth potential of our economies, also from a monetary policy perspective. And with this, I would end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So as I said earlier, please think about your questions. I'm going to ask a first question while you think through. And then I'll take two or three at a time. So first of all, thank you so much, Pablo. I mean, you shied away from using the word lessons, which for those of you who speak Latin is lectio, but you ended up giving more of a lecture, or in Latin, leggere, in the sense of almost a reading from a text. It felt a little bit like reading a text on a textbook on monetary policy. I wanted to ask you to continue in this broad sense with the following slightly more precise question. You were part of the mission review of the ECB back in 2000, a process that took quite a while, 2019 to 2020, a very well thought out process, and one that I think was expected to sow the seeds for the next time there will be a review, maybe in a few years or others. That past review focused on some of the important lessons that you brought or reflections, and was part of a response to assessments of how our star had changed in the previous 10, 20 years, of the fear that inflation expectations may have been anchored too low, the extent to which QE was now part of a tool, or to what extent financial stability now had to be a consideration. If you were to, taking your reflections and thinking now ahead of in 2-3 years a new mission review and the work ahead, partly inspiring this academic audience, how would you translate it into what you think some of the next mission review would focus on? Across all these different dimensions?
Well, in fact, Ricardo, the Governing Council of the ECB will be performing a new review next year. So it's already scheduled. And we are starting to have some conversations. Of course, I won't be there after June, but they will continue with these conversations in order to have a proper review in 2025. I think many of the comments I've made, in my view, should be considered, no, in this review. Probably the first one is precisely in the role of supply side shocks. It's obvious that supply side shocks have been prevalent, no, in the last 3 years, but we have also the perception that this might also be the case in the future. Mainly because what we see in the horizon is geopolitical risks, that the translation of, if these risks materialize, of course, in economic terms, would mean mainly a negative supply shocks. No? And the reality is that in the analysis that we did to produce the outcome of the 2021 strategy review of the ECB, we didn't pay much attention to this. It's not that we didn't pay attention at all, because I was mentioning even a paragraph on which this was considered, but to a certain extent, I think that it's not only about our review, but even the economic literature, no, and the monetary policy economies in particular. We haven't paid sufficient attention to these. No? And the fact is that the consequences in terms of the optimality of the actions of monetary policy might differ in a very significant manner. But first and foremost, what I think we have to focus is on the channels of transmission of these shocks. I mean, we've learned a lot during the last 3 years about supply chain problems. No, I discovered so many things about our dependence, no? On energy, but not only on energy, on food as well. Well, maybe we would have known this beforehand. Maybe perhaps we would have acted differently or not, but at least we would have known better. No, that's for sure. If I had to choose one topic, that for me would be one of the most the most important ones.
Terrific. So let me open it up, and yes, I'll call in a few people. Let me start on the side with the gentleman here in the front. Where's the microphone? Oh, there it is. The lady's coming.
Thank you, Governor. David Teeters, PhD student here at LSE and professor of finance at ESA Business School in Spain. I noticed that you didn't discuss the global context of monetary policy at the euro system. Specifically, your counterpart on the other side of the Atlantic just mentioned that they're going to be tapering QT more than expected in the context of what is financial markets are concerned about, fiscal dominance. Article that was published by Calamaris last year at the St. Louis Fed. And also earlier this week, the Bank of Japan did a very sizable intervention in FX markets. I would be curious as to your context for global macro. Thank you.
I have the lady right there.
Thank you. I'm Kai. I'm a data scientist with no affiliation with LSE. So I'm quite curious to learn the last slides you showed. I'm not very familiar with all those like terms, but I'm very familiar with modeling and forecasting. So I'm wondering how real time all those estimates are, and since we're already at 2024, and how we look at the actual natural interest rate and compare it with those estimates and see who has produced the most accurate estimates.
Yes, thank you. Fabio Balboni, European economist at HSBC. So just one quick question. You focused a lot on risk management, inertia, uncertainty. Now, we just had a very interesting prints of GDP, for instance, recently. Spain is nothing short of booming, you know, the last couple of quarters. And inflation is coming down, but with quite a lot of uncertainty on where it will settle. Now, against that backdrop, what makes you and in general the ECB quite confident seemingly that rates are restrictive and fairly confident again seemingly about cutting rates in June and possibly further out? Thank you very much.
Take as many as you wish, in whatever order you want.
No, thank you. I mean, on this discussion of fiscal dominance, it's true. I mean, we've spent the last probably 3 years using these terms of fiscal dominance, financial stability dominance, and other kind of even climate dominance, no, at some point. Well, the reality is that, and this is one of the main insights of my experience of the last 6 years as a governor of the Bank of Spain and therefore member of the governing council of the ECB, but even previously that I was attending the meetings, no, without being in the main table, is that these issues doesn't play any role in the making. So people around the table have very clear mandate. They know the mandate, which that is, of course, price stability. They have a clear definition of price stability. All the decisions that we take are based on this. And of course, there might be from time to time an impact of our decision on financial stability, as I've been discussing, on fiscal sustainability, as well, to a certain extent I was also touching upon this in the presentation, but of course these are not elements that are taken into consideration when deciding on monetary policy. Then second, on our start and the revisions of, I mean, this is one of the problems. When I was mentioning that there is uncertainty about the estimates, and I was showing the range, and each of these point estimates are also with very high confidence intervals. It's also what you were mentioning is also true, that very often they are also revised
exposed. Very similar, by the way, to the concept of potential output growth, which is to a certain extent a very similar variable. We have a long experience in estimating potential output growth for many, many countries. One of the main problems is precisely the fact that the estimates on real time are not sufficiently stable, and it's very often that not only the size but also the sign changes when you have more information. In particular, those models that are typically statistical models are very often giving outcomes that are revised and with a significant magnitude. And then on the last question, well, I think the numbers that we have observed for the last 2 days in terms of inflation, they show a slight negative surprise, okay, but very minimal one, both for headline and core inflation. I've always liked to analyze the data, not looking only to the last data point. The fact that the Governing Council of the ECB has gained a lot of confidence on its forecast is based on the fact, as I've shown in one of the charts, I think it was the first one, that the errors that the staff has committed in the last 4 quarters are close to zero, or even negative, in the sense that inflation was even slightly lower than they were initially expecting. And this is the crucial element to think, if you take into account that the projections of the ECB staff now, well, those that were produced in March, are projecting inflation to be at 2% in mid-2025. And very important that this forecast is based on the market expectation for rates that were prevalent before the March meeting, that included a June cut. I mean, the combination of all these factors is what it is leading us to that conclusion.
Very good. I'll go to a second round. So there, just next to you. Yep, perfect.
Hi, Lorenzo Codogno, a visiting professor here at the LSE. I have 3 questions, if I may. First question is, we got the new GDP and inflation data yesterday, and I would like to ask you, what is your feeling about the level of current GDP relative to potential, relative to equilibrium output? So what's your feeling? What do you think is the distance now relative to equilibrium? A second question is related to inflation resilience, especially debt of services. So what's your take of the recorded resilience of services inflation of the past few months? And the third question is maybe something that you haven't mentioned about the lessons of the past few years, which is the strange behavior of the economy, in a sense that various sectors of the economy have performed in a very different way. Okay, right now we still have probably manufacturing recession, while the rest of the economy is doing well. And what are the implications for monetary policy going forward?
Very good. From now on, there's only one question, otherwise I don't have time. There was someone, who was it? Well, I can go there right away, but yes.
Slightly hypothetical question, but imagine that Spain is not part of the Eurozone. Do you think that the inflation would experience the similar pattern in Spain as it experienced when it was a part of the Eurozone, and potentially how do you think that the monetary policy will be different in that scenario?
Okay, and I'll go to this gentleman over here.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi, thanks for the talk. I'm Pedro. I'm a master's student here. And my question is, a lot of people would say that the European Union has a debt problem, a sovereign debt problem in some countries. And do you think that the recent hike has reduced in some way this monetary space if there was to be another shock. Thank you.
Very good. We have five questions. I'm going to add one more just from the online, and then don't feel answer only a few if you want, and then we'll do a final round. Someone online, Yash, an LSE alum in India, asks a very pertinent question, which is, after the large impact on the cost of living, how do you talk to the public at large and restore their trust insofar as they have suffered through this large increase in the cost of living?
No, I think that I will start with this one because I think it's an important one. I don't think that monetary policy could have avoided, we all know, such inflationary spike when this was coming by the combination of the supply side shocks and the demand that was recovering from the pandemic. And we need to explain this to citizens, okay? So the role of the central bank is precisely to guarantee that this inflation spike doesn't entrench into expectations and then becomes a permanent problem or a persistent problem, then in the end that's the role of the central bank precisely, you know, to avoid that this is the case. And I think we've done, tend to think that good communication over all these years, I mean, not only at the ECB level, but governors in particular at the domestic level, I'm relatively confident that people have understood, you know, and that we have keep our confidence or the confidence of citizens on us as relatively strong, even if of course they suffer for this inflationary episode. Then on this question of debt and rates, first I should maybe incorporate a nuance to your assessment. I don't think Europe or the euro area as a whole has a public debt issue. In fact, the debt of the whole euro area is not very significant as compared to other jurisdictions, but of course there is a lot of heterogeneity across countries. And we know, because we have the experience of the sovereign debt crisis for sure, that the fact that there are some imbalances, in this case fiscal imbalances in some countries, can spill over negatively to the rest of the European Monetary Union. This is why we have a stability and growth pact. This is why it's so important for an European Monetary Union to have a fiscal rule. And this is why I was emphasizing in my talk that it is absolutely crucial now that we have a new SGP, that it is fulfilled by all countries, no? And which in the end will provide for a fiscal adjustment, but a gradual fiscal adjustment, whose length will also take into consideration structural reforms or investment in certain aspects and dimensions that we think now that they are absolutely needed. No? So that's the main, I would say, message from the side of fiscal policy. And then coming back to Lorenzo's points, your first question, Lorenzo, you were asking about the output gap, no? In the end. Whether this is slightly negative, whether it's zero, whether it's slightly positive. I mean, with all the revisions in the data that we've been going through, in particular in 2023, probably anything that I would say now in two quarters, even the numbers that you were referring to, the Q1 has been accompanied by a revision of Q4, which is now a negative 0.1 as compared to the 0%. So there was, in the end, a recession in the euro area at the end of the last semester of the year. I mean, what it is obvious is that even if the euro area has recovered from the level of GDP that was prevalent before the pandemic, but the growth rates, in particular of 2023, this 0.4%, was very, very low. If you compare it to the evolution in the euro area, sorry, in the US, it's been dramatically much lower. This means that probably we are clearly below potential at this stage, and that we might be recovering the level of potential in 2024 and 2025, depending, of course, on whether the numbers that we have observed for the first quarter are only an outlier or will be continued by higher numbers. No, I don't know exactly what the magnitude of this negative output gap is, but certainly, in my view, is still negative.
And then you were also asking about divergence by sectors. Well, for monetary policy, let's put it this way, it's already very tricky to focus on the whole economy. But of course we are paying, and this is related to my talk and the fact that we are having also negative supply shocks. This is affecting different sectors. This is clear. It's also related, by the way, to what you were mentioning, the fact that service inflation is more sticky. By the way, we were expecting it to be stickier. Because this is the historical pattern of services inflation. I'm always emphasizing that we cannot be surprised by something that we are anticipating. Services inflation was expected from the very beginning to be stickier. Also, not only because demand on services has remained very buoyant, also because we know that it's more intensive on labor. We knew that to a certain extent wages were going to catch up for the real losses that were observed in 2022. There were very good arguments. There is less competition. They are subject to less competition, international competition, etc., etc. So to a certain extent, we are also paying more attention to these divergences across sectors and incorporating also more heterogeneity, sectoral heterogeneity in our models, in order precisely to capture the transmission of our monetary policy on the different sectors and the spillovers of one sector to the other. I'm not saying with this that we are at the end of this process of learning. Probably the last 3 years are again a good signal to us that we have to invest more on this particular topic. You are completely right.
Very good. I wanted to go to the side, but we're 10 minutes over, and so I'm weary of that. So with apologies to that side, tough luck for the right wing here. Let me finish by just thanking so much Pablo Hernandez de Cos for sharing with us his wisdom, his lessons, especially in this environment. Many of the people in the audience are academics and students looking for what are the great questions to work on. And your lecture could not have been better in that sense, insofar as it showed us some of the questions that you faced, and you were able to expose them not only clearly, but also with the right humility that one has in terms of the seek for knowledge, which is the main mission of our school. So please join me in thanking Pablo for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.